I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Police believe a Virginia Tech student from South Korea, 23-year-old Cho Song-hui, is responsible for killing 30 people trapped inside a building at that school yesterday. And one of two handguns used in that attack was also used in the shooting in a dormitory 2 hours before, which left two people dead. Here's Virginia State Police Colonel Steve Flaherty.
It's certainly reasonable for us to assume that Cho was the shooter in both places, but we don't have the evidence to take us there at this particular point in time. We also have no evidence to indicate that there's any accomplice at either event.
A South Korean foreign ministry official says we are in shock beyond description. Joining us from Virginia is WPIN radio reporter Drake Anderson. Drake, what more do we know about Cho Song-hui?
Well, right now, the only thing we know is he was from South Korea. He was a senior English major at Virginia Tech. He was over here as a resident alien in the United States. We also know that he was living on campus. Now, he did not live in West Amboy Johnson, or West AJ, as they're calling it. He did not live in that dorm that the first shooting happened, but he was on campus. And other than knowing the handguns that were found at the scene, and there was a disturbing message left in his dorm room, the contents of that haven't been released at this point. Other than that, we really don't know a whole lot about the suspect here.
Well, he has been described as a loner. A student who answered the phone at the Virginia Tech Korean Student Association says the members there don't know him. We're wondering, early reports yesterday said that the killing in the dorm was preceded by a fight between a girl and her boyfriend, and the resident assistant rushed in to help. He was killed and she was killed. So have police said anything about whether or not there was a motive? Was the alleged shooter involved in some sort of fight with a girlfriend?
Well, what they're saying is that the first incident, as you're talking about at West AJ, they listed as domestic in nature, and that's probably what happened, is it started as a fight. He shot the two victims there, then apparently went back to his dorm room, because there is that two-hour time period between the 715 911 call that was the first received, and, of course, the shootings at Norris Hall, which were a couple hours later. So they do believe that something happened there. They did have a person of interest that they were interviewing yesterday. They did not say that he was a suspect. They did not bring him into custody, but he was a friend of one of the two in the dorm room, so they were trying to get some information regarding the possibility that that is what happened and that's what led to these attacks.
And now the AP is reporting unnamed law enforcement officials saying the serial numbers were filed off some of the weapons, and a receipt for a 9mm Glock handgun was found in Cho's backpack. It apparently was purchased last month. At the press conference, did they say any more about the weapons used in the shootings? Were they legal?
They did not say whether they were legal or not. I do believe in the press conference on the previous evening, the 7:30 news conference, they did say that they had thought he had purchased them in the state of Virginia. It was a 9mm handgun, also a .22. They did not say whether they were legal or illegal. Of course, you mentioned they did. They have matched the ballistics in the first shooting to one of the handguns at the second shooting. They did not come out and say whether it was the 9mm or the .22, and they did not come out to say yes or no that this guy was involved in both of them. They do believe he was involved in both of them, but they don't have the forensics to back that up at this point.
Right. And did officials address the criticism that they didn't react quickly enough to protect students? They didn't send out the email to the whole student body until the second attack was underway?
On the news conference yesterday evening, they did come up with a more detailed timeline last night of, all the events that happened. Now, they did not even address it this morning. Matter of fact, no questions were even asked this morning during the about 20-minute news conference where they did name the suspect. There is another one scheduled for around 5 o'clock this afternoon or this evening. I think they're trying to move away from that and trying to not worry about blame and trying to get all the details on this attack at this point.
Drake Anderson, reporter with WPIN, the Fox Radio affiliate in nearby Dublin, Virginia. Drake, thank you for helping us today and yesterday as well. Thank you.
Sure, not a problem. Thank you.
Well, President and Mrs. Bush are attending memorial service for the shooting victims at the university today on an eerily quiet campus. Jason Pyatt is a mechanical engineering student at Virginia Tech. He's a junior from Lynchburg, Virginia. He lives off campus but was on campus yesterday. Jason, as the shooting was happening, did you know what was going on?
Well, we knew what the media knew because everybody was on their cell phones. And then you hear, all right, well, there was a couple that was shooting, there were a couple victims, and then there were four victims, and then there was one fatality, and it just kind of kept building from there. And then there were seven victims, and we saw this. We saw a guy run out of the building with blood on his arm, like an older guy, like a faculty member. And that was when we realized that the police really didn't have a handle on the situation because it was kind of chaotic looking, you know. And this guy's been shot, and he's running out of the building, and there's still more going on, and obviously there's a pretty big situation here. You know, what happened yesterday was really terrible, but now we got to deal with the wake of it, and that's just like dealing with. I keep hearing the stories on the news, you know, the eyewitness accounts and everything, and they keep talking about everything that everybody was going through, and I guess that's important, but it hurts. It's really painful for me to listen to that over and over again, you know. Mm-hmm. Minute by minute accounts, and then all of a sudden, next thing you're going to see is, oh, for the next 6 months to a year, we're going to have all this debate about security in the schools and who screwed up and all that. And it's just like, it just feels like after what happened yesterday, the fact that we got so much more of this crap ahead of us is just, it's not cool.
It's pretty dispiriting.
Yeah.
Well, then I'm only gonna raise this to then move on. What do you think? Do you think that's a worthy discussion of who was to blame? I mean, do you think, for instance, that the university should have shut down the campus after the first shooting or informed people sooner?
I'm glad you asked me that because yesterday on CNN I made a remark. It was kind of an emotional thing.
Just to be clear, you said something about how you thought it was ridiculous that more hadn't been done. I'm paraphrasing you, but what were your feelings then in the moment? And as you said, they've changed.
I mean, my feelings then were there was a double homicide at 7:15 in the morning, and the first email that was sent out said, there has been a shooting incident, we are investigating it. You know, they sent that out at 9:26, and this whole thing happened at like 9:45. So it seemed like to me if two people die on campus, you should maybe let people know. But looking back on it now, they had reason to believe it was isolated. They did the best that they could do with the information they were given, and yeah, it was a mistake. Yeah, it was mishandled. But in their defense, you know, it's easy to point blame and say that a mistake was made. But on the other hand, on the flip side, can you say that you would have had the right answer? You know,
what do you want people to know about your school?
It's just it's a little mountain town with a rich local history, and it's a town. You know, it's like when the whole Columbine thing. Everybody knew Columbine, Colorado, but I'm sure it's just a small little town in Colorado. You see so much of this, and I don't know what the answer to the problem is. You know, everybody wants to point a finger and say, well, they got access to guns. Well, they had access to guns in 100 years ago, you know. People blame violent movies and TV, and then I just don't think that that's the problem, but I don't know what the answer is.
Jason, have you talked to your parents?
Yeah.
How are they doing?
They're better. They're doing fine. Once they realized that my brother and I were okay,
Your brother's there too?
He's a freshman. So I don't even know from his perspective. Virginia Tech must be real bad. I've been here for a little while.
Do your parents want you to come home?
Nah, no mention of that. There's nothing to run from here.
Well, Jason, we wish you well over the rest of your school year.
Thank you.
Jason Payette, a student at Virginia Tech. Well, how safe are schools? Virginia Tech had been working on a system to get emergency alerts to students by cell phone text messages. The University of Cincinnati has put a public address system in all of its buildings. But the University of Washington created a safety team charged with herding people into safe areas in the event of violence. And that system failed when a staffer was killed by her ex-boyfriend on April 2nd. So can schools really protect against random violence? Well, that is the business of Michael Dorn of Safe Havens International. He's a security consultant. He recently wrote about preventing weapons assaults in Campus Safety magazine, and he joins us on his cell phone as he tries to catch a plane. Michael, thank you and welcome.
Hello. Good day, ma'am.
And I'm reading through your 12 tips for cracking down on weapons assaults on campuses and in places like hospitals. You know, it's really stunning. You say things like deploy gun detection animals, use metal detection, security X-ray equipment. Is that really possible on a huge campus like Virginia Tech with half the population living off the campus? In fact, 11,000 people heading to the campus yesterday morning, not even on their email, for instance. Is it really possible?
It's all situational. For example, in that setting, you might use, if it was appropriate, metal detection for a special event like a basketball game.
Yeah.
Gun detection dogs have proven to be very effective at universities to randomly screen student vehicles to deter people from bringing a gun to campus.
When you say it's been successful, do you believe that gun attacks have been deterred?
I know for a fact. I've been involved with quite a few that have been stopped. I was a practitioner in this field for 20 years. For example, my school district police department stopped 6 planned school shootings, 2 planned a planned double suicide, and a planned school bombing. So I know for a fact that the majority of campus weapons assaults can be prevented. You can't prevent everything, and it's too early to make statements about this particular situation. But there are an array of techniques that we teach all over the world on this topic, visual weapons screening, training school police and university police and staff to notice when someone's carrying a gun based on certain physical behaviors of a gun violator. My officers stopped 3 planned campus shootings using those techniques.
Just by looking to see if they see a gun under a jacket or on...
It's a little more complicated than that. The gun violator reacts to the presence of the gun on their body, and the individual officers have recovered as many as 1,200 guns in their careers using visual weapons screening.
Michael, I have to stop you. I'm stunned. You're saying that you really believe you have stopped this many assaults on college and what, high school campuses?
Ma'am, I don't believe. I know for a fact. I mean, these people went to prison. I mean, we convicted 13 people in the events where they targeted other individuals. So it's not believed. We know these were imminent shootings where loaded guns were recovered. I know others have used our training to stop planned shootings at colleges, universities, and K-12 schools. Again, you can't prevent everything, but the vast majority of these can be prevented. And for every incident that we see like this, we see dozens that are successfully averted.
The New York Times is reporting that a campus-wide alert didn't go out until the attack at Norris Hall, the second attack, had started. Let's talk about a campus-wide alert. We're hearing from other schools. Texas A&M University, the vice president there, said there's no one magic communication system where you can press a button and let everyone know what's going on in a big campus. Is that true, or is there technology that's coming out? I mean, should there be speaker systems throughout a college campus so that you can press a magic button and everyone can hear something?
I would say that, like other organizations like that, a college or university should be equipped with voice communication, emergency enunciation systems. There are rapid phone call systems. We've helped design them. Our experience has been that a lot of the particularly mid-sized and larger K-12 public school systems have far more in place to prevent and respond to crisis situations than a lot of the larger universities do.
Yeah.
My school district police officers 10 years ago had rifles in their patrol cars. We had a gun detection dog. We protected about the same population size-wise as this university. And, when I look, I worked at the university police setting for 10 years and K-12 setting for 10, and there's a common misperception that K-12 schools have more of these incidents when, in fact, the homicide and aggravated assault rate is about 3 times higher for higher ed.
That's Michael Dorn, former chief of police for the Bibb County Public School System in Georgia. He travels the world now as head of the international nonprofit Safe Havens International. In fact, he's on his cell phone in an airport right now. We're keeping him from his airplane, and we really appreciate it, because when we come back after a quick break, we'll talk to him about arming on-campus cops. Some schools are against it. Back after a quick break with Michael Dorn, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're back with more from Michael Dorn of Safe Havens International. It's a nonprofit firm based in Georgia that advises organizations, including many schools, about security. Dorn has worked as a police officer in a university setting, and he was the chief of police for the Bibb County Public School System in Georgia, and he's with us on his cell phone from an airport. Michael, I want to talk about where we left off, arming campus police. Just last year, Virginia passed a law banning guns carried by students on campuses like Virginia Tech. But Virginia Tech did have armed campus security police. Many schools are loath to do that. They say it's going to lead to more violence. You write in Campus Safety magazine, it might be time to rethink that.
My child will not attend a university or college that does not have armed police on campus. And I go beyond an officer being equipped with a handgun. We strongly advise that campus police have access to something safer to use, and when you've got one of these type of situations, which involves a carbine or a rifle, secured usually in the trunk of their cruiser. I've been there when people didn't die because properly equipped and trained campus police were on the job and empowered to do what they needed to do. This is not our worst act of violence for a campus. It's the most deaths by gunfire alone. But back in 1927, we lost over 40 people at an elementary school in Bath, Michigan.
Yes.
when a school board member attacked with firearms and explosives, the 95 killed in a Chicago Catholic school killed by a fourth grader in 1958. So, you know, there's risk out there, and we have to assess that risk, and there are proven measures to reduce dramatically the probability that these events will occur.
Let's talk about that, because you say work to reduce triggering behaviors. We're seeing reports that schools in, for instance, the New England area, MIT, UMass Amherst, have networks of faculty, assistants, resident assistants, in some cases mental health professionals. They put together this network. They figure out who the at-risk of violence kids might be, and then they closely supervise them. Is that what you're talking about when you say work to reduce triggering behaviors, or have a multidisciplinary threat assessment team?
Yes, my school district police department began using multidisciplinary threat assessment in 1990, and we stopped three of the planned shootings, the planned bombing, and the planned double suicide with that method. And the universities are starting to use that technique that's been proven to be very effective in K-12 schools. Another realm we see, most weapons assaults at a secondary campus are not anything remotely like this tragic and horrible incident. They're an altercation. Someone gets into a fight and pulls a knife and stabs somebody. One of the most common precursors to violence on any campus is a physical assault. A fist fight turns into a knife fight or a gunfight. And we've seen a number of these cases turn into shootings and stabbings where university officials tend to not want to use the criminal justice system, for example, and ticket or arrest or take serious disciplinary action against those lower-level precursors to more severe violence.
Right. So if somebody's fighting at a ball game or, you know, girls might be fighting in a bathroom, officials have to really pay attention to that because it could escalate. And we again, turning to Virginia Tech, we don't know if the two events are tied together, but we do know that the first double homicide was because of a fight, according to eyewitnesses, between a girl and her boyfriend.
Yes, that pattern we see over and over. It's very common in K-12 schools, and I tell in my seminars, we're doing 30 seminars right now around the country on this topic for Indiana Insurance and Utica Insurance, some of the largest insurance carriers in the country, and we tell our attendees, yesterday at Purdue, we told them, you know, every time someone strikes somebody on your campus, your risk of a weapons assault goes up, I would say, about as much as every time somebody has a knife or a gun on your campus. Because there's such a strong correlation to the more typical weapons assault. And again, this is an extraordinarily atypical case that proves that even the very best of universities can have these tragedies, and that's not the first time we've seen that type of thing, unfortunately.
Michael Dorn, I want to ask you about the thinking about gun training. We're reading that the thinking is different today in many schools than it was, say, perhaps prior to Columbine, as to how you approach someone with a gun in a building.
Yeah, in some situations, and actually we had put that into place 2 years before Columbine. I had the privilege to go to the State of Israel for training a couple of years before that tragic incident. And the Israelis did a live fire demonstration for what is now in this country called rapid deployment. They've started using it since the early 1970s with the Malat massacre at an elementary school there with a terrorist attack. And I came back and equipped our officers with rifles and new training to go in and neutralize an individual. Now, again, that's just a piece of this situation. That is a response measure. But that's when I mentioned that officers need rifles. At first, people get upset when you say that, but they need to understand that a handgun is normally not a very effective weapon to neutralize an active gunman. The officer has to have a shoulder-fired weapon. If you're trying to neutralize a threat at 40 to 60 yards with a handgun, you tend to be as great a danger to bystanders as you are to the assailant. So that's why I mentioned that university and school police, and many of them increasingly are equipped with safer weapons, which involve a carbine or a rifle, a shoulder-fired weapon, so they can more safely engage this type of individual.
Yeah. Michael Dorn, I know, you know, there are people, and you know this too because you've addressed it, that there are people who say bringing more guns on campus to protect kids is not the answer. You say it is. You say you've got proof. But there are also people, I'm sure, saying nothing. There's going to be incidents that you just can't stop. Do you agree?
I say they're not experts in this field. I've done this for 30 years. I sat across the table from people wearing handcuffs that didn't kill innocent students because we had the measures that we just talked about in place. I've seen it work. I've seen kids not die. I visited East High in Green Bay, Wisconsin, where they use these measures to stop an imminent shooting. And we see a lot of the quiet success stories out there that do demonstrate that the different things we're talking about in a lot of cases, in the majority of cases, do affect these outcomes in a positive way.
Michael Dorn of Safe Havens International, a nonprofit based in Georgia that advises universities and hospitals, others on security measures, recently wrote about preventing weapons assaults in Campus Safety magazine. Michael, I know it's been you've been on a cell phone trying to do your work there, you know, getting on a plane, but we really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, and our heart goes out to the families and to the people at this university. It's a terrible situation, and we wish them the very best in their recovery efforts.
Okay. Tomorrow on Here and Now, actress and activist Mia Farrow and newswoman Liz Walker on why the road to peace in Darfur goes through China. Also, folk icon David Bromberg. He's been gone for 26 years. Where has he been? That's tomorrow. Still ahead, the new Tolkien book, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Later in the show, a story we couldn't bring you until we signed a confidentiality agreement. But now it can finally be told. We have a review of the newly released Tolkien book, Children of the Hurin, one of the most closely kept secrets in literature. That's later, but first, state media in China is reporting that 140 children and their teachers have taken ill after what's described as a huge amount of sulfur dioxide was released from a fertilizer plant yesterday. Well, our next guest won't be surprised. China's economy is the world's fourth largest, and its economy has more than doubled in size since the end of 2000. Add to that increasing diplomatic ties and military presence on the international stage, and China seems to be racing ahead. But Harry Harding says that, in fact, the country is walking on a tightrope, and today's news is a large part of that problem. Harry Harding is chair of the China Task Force at the Eurasia Group, a political research firm based in New York. He's also university professor of international affairs at George Washington University and writes about China in this month's Foreign Policy magazine. Harry, you take on the general perceptions about China and ask us to think again. So let's start with the perception that China's biggest problem is economic. You say what?
I say that they are more ecological than economic. You have a country that, in terms of air pollution and water pollution and soil pollution and simply shortages of usable water, is facing a series of crises.
Only 1% of the surface water available to Shanghai is safe to drink, you write.
That's right. In some parts of the country, the water is so bad that you can't even use it for industrial purposes. In other words, you can't only not drink it, and you cannot only not put it on soil for agricultural purposes, but it is so, you know, full of pollutants that it can't be used for many industrial purposes. So water is probably the biggest single problem, but you've got various kinds of chemical spills, you've got chronic air pollution, and then in the health area, you've got chronic disease, communicable disease like HIV/AIDS and hepatitis, and then you've always got the possibility of an acute outbreak. We've already seen a SARS outbreak, and so you've got a variety of actual and potential epidemics that could either be long-term problems or very immediate problems that could spread potentially worldwide. And we didn't even touch the issue of greenhouse gases. And China is about to surpass the United States as the single biggest emitter of greenhouse gases within the next year or two.
Well, and that brings us to a second perception, that a second Tiananmen crisis is inevitable. Remember,
right,
of course, the Tiananmen Square crisis in 1989, huge protests. And you say that's hardly true, but what is possibly true is that the discontent will make itself apparent in smaller outbursts in reaction to some of these things you've just been talking about.
Yeah, exactly. I think that the chances of another Tiananmen crisis, which I would define as huge urban protests, multiple cities, very difficult to put down, the chances of that are not zero, they're low. Whereas the chances of a large number of localized protests, especially in the countryside, the chances of that are 100%. They're happening all the time on a daily basis.
But what are some of those protests first before we move on?
A very frequent problem has been the expropriation of land used by farmers for some kind of industrial or residential development. That's been a big problem in suburban areas. The abuse of power, corruption, or arbitrary taxes and fees by local officials is another frequent reason for protest. So these are happening all the time across China. It's one reason why the government is now trying to talk about a harmonious society and trying to address some of these issues.
Well, so with that, with increased awareness of the outside world, increased globalization, increased protests, increased possibility of environmental problems, we left out others, fights over water rights and such.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What do you think of the country's stability politically?
Well, in terms of the national level leadership, things have become much more institutionalized. But the big question now is whether the new leadership of Hu Jintao, the president, and Wen Jiabao, the prime minister, whether that new leadership is going to be able to consolidate their power at the 17th Party Congress coming up this fall. There are clearly deep divisions within the top leadership over priorities and speed of various reforms. And so we'll be watching very, very carefully to see whether they have a successful party Congress and begin to put a leadership in place that can work together to address the country's problems.
Hmm. Well, what do you think, Harry Harding? Do you think that the things we've been talking about, increased protests over environmental issues, for instance, do you think that means we're seeing a transition to a more democratic society, or how would you define it from a Chinese point of view?
Well, by any Western definition of the term, absolutely not. There are still enormous restraints on the press, on a ban on independent political parties, very tight restrictions on non-governmental organizations. Competitive elections are basically only at the very lowest grassroots. There are some experiments with making the system more responsive, but basically the Chinese leadership is trying to square the circle. How do you have a more accountable and responsive government without a pluralistic democracy?
Well, I want to ask you one last question on trade before we let you go. In recent news about trade, the Bush administration announced that it's going to be charging China with illegal trade barriers and with failing to act on piracy of things like books and music, and taking China to court at the World Trade Organization. Now, some people wonder if we're seeing, a reversal of 6 years of conciliatory trade policy towards China, as those people would see the Bush administration's treatment of China, or if, in fact, maybe the Bush administration is just taking this action to stave off even tougher moves on the part of the newly democratic Congress. What do you think is happening there?
Well, I think the administration is very well aware that the Congress is restless. The Bush administration is proceeding on two tracks. They have a dialogue with the Chinese to address the underlying structural issues, but they're increasingly using the trade dispute resolution mechanism of the WTO to try to solve some immediate problems.
Does the U.S. really have leverage, given that so much of our economy is floated, by China? I mean, what incentive would the Chinese have to think about these issues?
Well, the Chinese are increasingly talking about scientific and technological innovation of their own. And so there are going to be a lot of Chinese scientists and designers and inventors who will have, and writers and musicians who will also have their own intellectual property. So basically, the Chinese government has to realize that this is not just foreigners complaining. This is going to be Chinese inventors and creative people who are going to benefit.
Harry Harding, chair of the China Task Force at the Eurasia Group, also professor of international affairs at George Washington University, asking us to think again about China. Professor Harding, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Well, here we are in another week with a spasm of news, and we want to take a second to remind you that we want to hear your thoughts on China, on the shootings at Virginia Tech. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Coming up before we go today, Orcs, Elves, and Warriors. The son of J.R.R. Tolkien presents his father's new work, The Children of Húrin, a dark tale that takes place in Middle Earth 6,000 years before The Lord of the Rings, and our reviewer speaks Elvish. You're listening to Here and Now. As Bill McKibben writes in his new book, Deep Economy, ever since Richard Nixon took the U.S. off the gold standard in the early 1970s, U.S. money is no longer backed by anything of intrinsic worth. Its value rests only on the shared confidence of its users. Well, here now is Kevin Donovan, went to visit a small New England town where that trust is being put to a test with an experiment in alternative economy.
On a Friday morning in South Agramont, Massachusetts, a woman, white-haired and cheerful, walks into the Salisbury Bank and Trust and hands the teller behind the counter a stack of bills.
I'd like to exchange $90 for 100 Berkshires.
Sure.
The teller takes the woman's money and opens a small white box filled with what looks like dollar bills. But instead of greenbacks featuring founding fathers and presidents, the teller hands the woman paper currency embossed with the likenesses of W.E.B. Du Bois, Herman Melville, and Norman Rockwell. These are Berkshires. They come in denominations of 1, 5, 10, 20, and 50, and not only are they exquisite, they're also real. The currency is backed by U.S. dollars and accepted by hundreds of businesses in the area. Think of Berkshires as a cash version of gift cards.
We look at Berkshires not as the currency, but as a complementary currency.
Susan Witt is one of the architects behind Berkshires. She says this effort is not some quaint small-town enterprise, but an experiment in alternative economics. The goal? Think globally, spend locally.
We can positively favor local production, whereas now with a single global currency, those that are favored are the largest players.
So why use Berkshires? Well, because they come with a built-in discount. Banks involved in the project have set up an exchange rate. For 90 cents, you get one Berkshire, and at businesses that accept Berkshires, your 90 cents buys a dollar's worth of merchandise. Meanwhile, merchants can use Berkshires at other businesses that accept them, or redeem them at the bank. They'll lose that 10 cents on the dollar if they do that, though. But Witt says she envisions a day when going to the bank won't be necessary.
With more Berkshires in the hands of more merchants, then those merchants are looking for local sourcing of goods in order to spend their Berkshires without turning them back to the banks.
Sean Stanton runs North Plain Farm on the edge of Great Barrington, another town in the southern Berkshires. He sells organic meats to local restaurants and markets, and he conducts as much as 15% of his business in Berkshires.
I've been able to spend every single Berkshire that I've gotten back into the local economy. My dentist takes Berkshires. I have a guy who mills lumber for me who takes Berkshires.
So does Rubiner's Cheesemongers, a gourmet cheese and meat shop on Main Street, where Sean sells some of his eggs and meat. Owner Matt Rubiner, who also runs an adjoining coffee shop, sees a lot of this new cash flowing in.
In our cafe, it's probably, 10 to 20% of sales are paid for with Berkshires, which is pretty high. In the store, it's a much smaller percentage, but a growing percentage.
Rubiner claims his cafe was the first to make a sale with Berkshires, a cup of coffee. Since then, Rubiner has accepted so many Berkshires, he hasn't been able to turn all of them back into the community. He's had to redeem them for dollars at the bank and take that 10% hit. It's a small price to pay, he says.
People are making a decision to come to the cafe versus some of the other cafes and businesses around town because we very gleefully accept Berkshires. They point that out to us, and that's worth the 10% right there.
This sort of conversation puts a sparkle in the eye of Berkshires inventor Susan Witt. She's heard all the complaints about the bookkeeping headaches, dealing in cash instead of plastic, profit margins. She doesn't mind the debate. In fact, she embraces it. Because in her grand scheme, something as simple as a Berkshire can help build community.
You're meeting the owners, you're meeting the staff, you're coming to understand the problems they're facing. That means as a citizen, you're better informed when you go to the voting booth.
The Berkshires effort has just passed the half-year mark, and already there are plans for a Berkshires ATM and a Berkshires debit card. And that controversial 10% discount may even be reduced or abandoned. Right now, Witt's group is sending letters to the hundreds of New Yorkers who own summer homes here in the Berkshires, asking them to participate in this experiment in an alternative economy. Inside each envelope, a complimentary Berkshire.
Here now is Kevin Donovan in Berkshire County, Massachusetts. For more on the Berkshires, go to our website, here-now.org. Still ahead, the newly released novel from Tolkien, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, fans of fantasy writer J.R.R. Tolkien will have cause to rejoice. Or fear. A new saga, The Children of Húrin, hits the store shelves. It's a prequel of sorts to the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Children of Húrin was begun by Tolkien in 1918, and when he died in 1973, the work was still unfinished. Now his son Christopher Tolkien has finished the task. How good a job did Christopher do, and how is The Children of Húrin as a read? Here to answer those questions is Mike Drought, Tolkien specialist and assistant professor at Wheaton College. And Mike, it's nice to see you again. Last time you were here, you spoke Elvish to us, so how would you say hello again?
I guess you would say Elen sila lumen amanti elmo, which means a star shines at the hour of our meeting.
I think in English that would be an appropriate greeting from here on out. This book has been generating quite a bit of excitement, so much so that when a bookstore by mistake put it on the shelves last week, there was this big uproar and they had to pull it out. Why is there so much anticipation?
Well, first of all, I think this is the first standalone kind of readable book that's been out there since The Lord of the Rings. There's been The Silmarillion, which came out in 77, and then a follow-up 12 volumes, History of Middle-earth, and also the 1983 Unfinished Tales. But each of those, well, maybe with the exception of The Silmarillion, but each of those is very scholarly. Here's what my father wrote. Here are the pieces of it. Here's where he left off. And in this one, Christopher Tolkien tries to put together a self-contained book that you can pick up and read like a novel rather than reading like a work of scholarship.
Right. We have heard that Christopher didn't write as much as he cobbled together.
Christopher writes very, very, very little. In fact, I think he's been very unfairly criticized for that about The Silmarillion. There were so many drafts and such a myriad of manuscripts that he didn't need to write anything. He just had to select which manuscript to follow and which bridging part to use and right. How to pull it together into one tale.
Right. So he, except maybe for a grammatical glitch here or there, apparently he didn't do much writing. But you mentioned The Silmarillion, and we should say that that's one of the reasons that Tolkien fans are a little nervous because, well, Christopher was excoriated for that, frankly. It's a collection of stories of Middle-earth. Critics called it Sell-a-Million. The concern was that this would be making Tolkien more of a brand than an author. Do you think that that happens with the current book?
I don't really think so. And I don't think that's a fair criticism of Christopher anyway. He's got more money than he knows what to do with. He's 80-something years old. It's not really about that. It's about him wanting to fulfill his father's last dreams and wishes, which were to get all those legends that he spent decades and decades working on, get them out there for the public to see. Though I will say that the branding probably helps and that it allows them to publish a beautiful book with gorgeous illustrations by Alan Lee.
Who worked on the films as well.
Yes, he has a very distinctive style and he did beautiful illustrations for this. It's got nice text, nice papers, a map, all of that. I don't think you'd have that if you didn't have the Tolkien franchise. But the story hasn't changed.
Well, let's tell us about this new story from The Children of Húrin. Where exactly does this book take place in the Lord of the Rings timeline?
Takes place about 6,000 years before Bilbo originally finds the ring.
So a while back.
The story is centered around the family of a great warrior, a human warrior, named Húrin. And Húrin has joined up with the good elves to fight the first Dark Lord. And the first Dark Lord is so much stronger than the second Dark Lord that Sauron was just his mere servant.
That's the Dark Lord of the Lord of the Rings, Sauron.
Yes, the one who made the rings.
Let's hear a little bit. The book is about the Children of Húrin, but before you move on to tell us more of the plot, give us a sense of the style. Why don't we hear a passage, and I understand this is about Húrin.
Yes, what I'm going to read is Húrin is a valiant warrior, and he's fighting a rearguard action to let the king of the elves retreat from a battle. And okay. He's going to stand there and fight when there's no one left.
Okay.
Last of all, Húrin stood alone. Then he cast aside his shield and seized the axe of an orc captain and wielded it two-handed. And it is sung that the axe smoked in the black blood of the troll guard of Gothmog until it withered. And each time that he slew, Húrin cried aloud, "Ore Entoluva! Day shall come again." 70 times he uttered that cry, but they took him at last alive by the command of Morgoth, who thought thus to do him more evil than by death. Therefore the orcs grappled Húrin with their hands, which clung to him still, though he hewed off their arms, and ever their numbers were renewed till he fell buried beneath them. Then Gothmog bound him and dragged him to Angband with mockery. Thus ended the Nirnaerth Arnodiad, as the sun went down beyond the sea. Night fell in Hithlum, and there came a great storm of wind out of the west.
Nirnaerth Arnodiad?
That means the battle of unnumbered tears.
Oh, of course it does. Well, I tell you, with these arms getting sliced off, it sounds as if it's very dark.
It is a very dark book. The plot of the book is what happens to the children of Húrin after their father is captured by this evil Dark Lord, and the Dark Lord puts a curse on him and his family.
Hmm.
And he says Húrin will have to sit in this chair on the mountainside and see everything that happens while the curse of Morgoth works its way throughout his family.
Including, we understand, his son Túrin, who is the centerpiece of the book. Who's Túrin?
Túrin is the greatest of all heroes of ancient Middle-earth, but everything he touches turns to disaster.
Oh.
It comes from the Finnish Kalevala and the tale of Kullervo the Hapless, where everything goes wrong, but it was also Tolkien's take on a way to change the whole Siegfried Dragonslayer away from this kind of Nietzschean Nazi Übermensch into someone who does the great thing of slaying the dragon, but also has a very, very hard life and doesn't crush every person in his path.
It's funny because we have a segment coming up on Beowulf and a one-man reading of Beowulf. I know you know the actor, Benjamin Bagby. But this is also reminding me of that, you know, classic tale. Yes, you can slay the dragon, but then you might make the dragon's mother angry. It sounds a little like that. There's repercussions to being a hero.
Tolkien would call this the northern view of heroism as opposed to the Greek or Latin view. And the northern view is that everybody's going to die in the end anyway. But you keep fighting. But it's not that triumph. It's not the triumph of the Greeks over the Trojans. It's a short-lived triumph, and then another monster shows up.
Yeah.
It's very cheery.
This is not bedtime story material. But still, do you think people who love The Lord of the Rings or The Hobbit are going to necessarily love this?
I think they will enjoy it much more than The Silmarillion, which The Silmarillion reads like a history book of the elves. This is much more of a self-contained novelistic story. The style is very different. But in terms of following one character and that character's psychological development and what happens to him, it's very much more like a regular novel that you would read.
Yeah. As someone who obviously loves this work, do you think this is it? I mean, you know, you've been very lucky that this has been cobbled together, but do you think there's more, or may this be it?
There possibly are two more. Tolkien thought that his old mythology could kind of be encapsulated in three great tales, which are the Children of Húrin, Beren and Lúthien, which is kind of a pre-story to the Aragorn-Arwen story at the end of Lord of the Rings, and the one of the fall of Gondolin, the destruction of a white, elvish, beautiful city. Each of those possibly could be put together the way this is put together. I don't know if that's in the plan. I have no insider knowledge about that.
Right. Well, just can you explain to us, you know, what is the appeal? What is it?
I think the appeal is to go to this other different world that is so beautifully realized in landscape and in beauty, everything from simple sunsets and the ocean and the sea and the forests and the mountains. And then to have it all happen at such incredibly high stakes that the whole world is at stake because of the things that individual people do. Individual people matter in changing the world, and it's dramatized this way. That's what I think is so powerful and why people want to keep going back to Middle-earth.
We've been talking about the brand new Tolkien book, The Children of Húrin, with Tolkien scholar and Wheaton College professor Mike Drought. Mike, how would you say, till next time, in Elvish?
Namarie.
Namarie, meaning?
Farewell. Till we meet again.
Back at ya. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.